Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to be talking home renovation today. It's a perfect time to make your home more energy efficient, I think, when you're doing a renovation. We'll talk about that with John Freiberger. John, a Wisconsin registered home inspector, specializes in evaluating older structures. Maybe you'd like some help to make your remodel more efficient, and certainly you probably have some home repair questions you want John to answer. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Love to hear from you. And John Freiberger, welcome back.
Great to be back, Larry.
Always fun to have you with us. You and I were talking just before the show, and you were talking about whether or not your home could actually be damaged by some remodel or a retrofit.
Yes. In particular, we are running into problems with people trying to make their homes more energy efficient and causing a lot of damage. Now, some of this we've known about for years. If you own a historic home, Larry, and you want to get tax credits for the improvement of that home, you are not allowed to insulate the sidewalls of your old 1890s brick house unless you install a complete interior vapor barrier.
Oh.
Because what we have found is when we re-insulate old 2x4 walls that have no insulation on the exterior at all, we end up with a lot of condensation on the back side of the sheathing. That is, the side of the sheathing is inside the wall. That causes mold, and it also causes the fasteners to rust. So we end up doing significant structural and air quality damage to houses that we insulate. The other thing that we've run into, and we're in court on this, we have, some insulators are local businesses, and some of them have been around for 40 and 50 years, and they do a great job. And others are franchises, and the franchises are a little bit worrisome, because a lot of the people who work for the franchises and even the owners don't understand building science. So what we found is that, let's say you've got your 1957 ranch house and you've got 3 inches of insulation in the attic. The attic is poorly vented. And you come up in that attic, Larry, and you add another foot of insulation. Well, all of a sudden, that attic used to be sort of warm in the winter due to the heat loss. Well, now it's colder. So now the humidity that's in that attic is colder, and that humidity condenses out. So you can have a 1950s ranch house that never had mold in the attic. You add insulation, you lower the temperature, increase the relative humidity, and all of a sudden you've got white mushrooms growing on the bottom side of your plywood.
And there are things that could be done to avoid that.
Well, there are, but the problem is, Larry, they tend to be expensive, and we have to have some understanding what's going on. Building science is something that really began in the 80s. You know, in the 70s and the 80s, we developed a lot of new ways, a lot of new products. So we came up with was wood, oriented strand board, laminated veneer lumber, all of these nice engineered woods. We came up with some of these great sheet-type insulations, the 4x8 sheets of 1-inch, 2-inch, 4-inch foam. And we started putting these on houses because they were great, they were efficient, they were cheap, and they caused mold and rot. So we really had to start studying what is wrong with these houses. We're putting in the new and improved stuff, and we're getting houses that do not stand up the way an old house stands up. So building science really began as we started to study the entire system that a house consists of.
Yeah, and so when you're going to retrofit, for example, and maybe you should, talk a little more about what retrofit is and how it relates to remodeling and renovation, but you got to know what you're doing.
Right, and really what we need to do is we need to hire somebody who knows what they're doing. Now, I don't think, Larry, we've had a program that's gone by where you and I have not talked about having an energy analysis of a home,
right?
Because that certainly is the way to start. And for listeners who haven't heard us say this a dozen times, it really consists of two things. One is we've got these wonderful thermal cameras now, Larry. I can actually go into your house and I can find every drywall screw. with thermal imaging because of this very, very slight difference of temperature, because that steel is transmitting a little bit more cold than the drywall. So we have X-ray vision now. We can really see into walls. We can see the temperature of everything, and the temperature can tell us whether we might have water in the wall, whether we've got air leakage, etc. So any good energy inspector has got one of these wonderful thermal cameras, and they can walk around your house and really tell you what's going on. The second thing, and sometimes almost the more important, is to pressure test. So we open the front door, put a big screen in there with a big fan, a calibrated fan with some pressure gauges, depressurize the house to 50 pascals, measure how much air is leaking into the house by maintaining constant pressure, and then we can go around the house with something like a smoke pencil, and we can find all the places that are air leaking. And what we know now after many years of study is that for the average house, 40% of the heat loss is actually through air leakage. And those are the things, two of the things we need to control. And the third, of course, is our humidity and our vapor transfer. So we need to be able to study those three things, whether we're putting an addition on a house, designing an addition, or whether we're taking an old house and we're going to energy retrofit it to make it more energy efficient.
Well, that home energy audit, certainly it's actually is very instructive. We had one done on the house and our lake home, and it was really interesting for me to follow the guy around as he did the work.
It's
surprising where you see some of those air leaks.
Indeed it is. And there are areas that we know where we always have problems. We know that the sill boxes and the ring joists. We see a lot of these houses with a cantilevered second floor. They have a jutty coming out.
Yeah.
Those things leak like you wouldn't believe.
Yes, they do. I know all about that.
Right. It's a cold bathroom and bedroom second floor floors, and we know exactly what's going on. And the nice thing, when I walk around with my thermal camera, I have, you know, Mrs. Smith or whoever it is looking over my shoulder, and I'm saying, look at this. Because when I do this work, and I guess this is a good advice for our listeners, Larry, is when you have the guy in the house, don't go grocery shopping while he's there.
Yeah.
Follow him around. Really come to understand how your house is working as a thermal system.
Yeah.
You know, get an education. It's going to take 2 hours out of your day, but
it's well worth it, I can tell you that.
Indeed it is.
Yeah. Well, Patrick in Rice Lake has a question for you, so let's go there. Patrick, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks.
What's on your mind today?
Well, you just touched on my question. You talked about cantilevers. The house that we bought last year has all of the closets, I shouldn't say all, but most of the closets in the bedrooms are cantilevered out about 30 inches. We had an energy audit done. We're taking care of adding insulation around them to make them better. We keep the closet doors slightly open so that there's air circulation so we don't have any moisture problems. So far, so good. What we wanted to do with one of the closets was actually build in, take the closet doors off and build in like a wardrobe. My question is that if we do that, the cabinet doors then would be closed, the drawers would be closed, and because that's cantilevered and is a natural cold spot, are we setting ourselves up for moisture problem within the built-in?
Yeah.
Well, that's entirely possible. So I think what we want to do is analyze the insulation so that we can keep the temperature, that the coldest possible spot inside the wall framing would be at least 40 degrees. And what we really need to do that, we can do it by putting insulation on the interior. So let's say you don't want to tear out your drywall walls. You could put a couple of inches of insulation on the interior and then build your wardrobe against it. That would help. Now, on the cantilevers, you mentioned you're going to insulate, but the question is, are you going to air seal, Patrick? Because,
yes.
Okay, good. Because for those who don't know as much as you do, insulation is a really nice air filter, but it does not block air. We go into houses built in the 70s and 80s, and we pull out insulation, and the insulation is black on one side. It looks like a dirty furnace filter. And that is because of all the air leakage coming in. So generally what we do is with these cantilevers is we try to spray foam them. If you've got the spray foam guy there, you know, maybe take that drywall out in the closet because they have already brought the truck over. They've already charged you for the mobilization. And why don't we go ahead and spray the wall cavities and maybe even spray an inch over the top to get rid of that thermal bridging. Because thermal bridging is really our enemy. And this is why when I take my thermal camera, if I go to Larry's house, I can show him every stud in the house. Because it is going to be a different temperature because it is sending more heat out of the house than the insulated areas. So come up with a complete, a fairly complete system and make sure that you've got that temperature warm enough that it is never going to hit the dew point.
There we go. Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling, Patrick. Appreciate it. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Gloria next in Platteville. Hi, Gloria.
Yeah, hi. I have a couple of questions for you. Thank you so much. Well, first of all, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
On the spring where we need to do an add-on, we have solar panels, and we want to do an add-on on our from the dining room. And actually, I don't know whether we should do a two-story type of thing because it's we want like a sunroof. We want to make sure that it's energy efficient. And I don't know if you do two levels or whether we just have the whole thing open and just have some stairs coming down. Can you maybe help me a little bit here? I don't know what to do. I'm like a neophyte, you know, like I'm out in the middle of the ocean and I'm swimming, but don't know where to go.
So you have a one-story ranch-style home now?
Yes, but it is open on the south, so the basement is down there, and we would go from the dining room. So then that would either we would do a two-level one, or we would actually just have it all open and then have a stairway that would go down and have it as a nice family room. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I'm like in the ocean and swimming.
Yeah, sure. Well, what you're planning is a lot easier to air seal and heat than if you were going up an additional story. I mean, what you're really doing is you're adding to your basement, which is a walkout basement. It doesn't feel like a basement where you're going to add it, and then the first floor. So we're not adding more floors to the house.
No.
The more floors we add to the house, the more air leakage we have. I mean, there's a reason when you drive by the local power plant and you see how tall the smokestack is.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's because the taller it is, the more stack effect you're going to get as you compress that warm air and send it out. So what you're looking at doing is really fairly simple. Are you using, who's drawing the plans for you? Is it a local lumber yard or are you using an architect?
Probably just the local guy is going to do it, but we're planning on having somebody come in. Actually, we're planning on having maybe the Amish kind of roughing it in.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And the other guy is, you know, he does plans, you know, at local.
Sure.
And probably have him. We probably won't have an architect other than my niece, who is a semi-architect.
Okay.
Well, when you're planning your insulation, try to have 60% of your insulation on the exterior of the framing. All right? So if you're building a 2x4 wall, you want to have probably at least 2 inches, if not 3 inches, of insulation on the outside. That gets rid of that thermal bridging Larry and I were just talking about.
Yeah, sure.
The other thing it does, going back to Patrick, is because you put that 3 inches of insulation on the exterior, the backside of that sheathing, even if your vapor barrier isn't real good, is never going to get cold enough to condense.
I see.
At that point, you can use an inexpensive, you know, high-density cellulose or something in the cavities. So think about getting 60% of that insulation outboard of the sheathing and the framing, and that is really going to help. And then look at air sealing. So on the exterior, you want to have Tyvek or Dow Styro Wrap or Henry House Wrap. And you want to make sure it's put on right, because 90% of it is not put on right. And again, there's something else Larry and I always say when we do this program, is that whatever you're doing, if you're going to put in Pella or Marvin windows or Anderson windows, download the installation instructions. If you're going to have a house wrap put on the house, download the installation instructions. Print two copies, one for you, one to the contractor, because the odds are the contractor's never seen it before.
Okay.
And you want him to follow those.
We want him to follow them. And if he knows, if you say, hey, I've got a copy and here's yours, he knows you're smarter than the average bear, and they are going to do it right.
Okay. We would be using 2x6 walls instead of 2x4. Our whole house has 2x6 walls.
Right. On a 2x6 wall, again, the 60% rule, so which means you're going to have more, possibly more insulation on the exterior depending upon what you have. If you just use the R19 bats on the inside, all right?
Sure.
So then what you're going to want to have on the outside is R30 insulation on the outside would be the minimum, R30.
Okay.
And with that, you may want to take a look at going with a urethane-type panel, Tough R, something like that. And you're probably going to be looking at 3 to 4 inches, probably 4 inches of insulation on the exterior.
There you go. Good luck with that, Gloria. Call back and let us know how it works out.
Yeah, you guys are so smart.
Well, John is anyway. I'm Larry Mueller, by the way. John Freiberger, our guest. Jill Nadeau, our producer, here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at home renovation and retrofitting your home for energy security with our guest today, John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates of Fitchburg, Wisconsin. Great to have him back. Certainly great to have you listening in. Lines are filled. The number is 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. And we'll go back to the phones. Dennis in Two Rivers up next. Dennis, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I've heard from a few people when there's condensation on a window, especially when it freezes like it does in mine, it means there's a leak somewhere. And I just wonder, is that really accurate?
Not necessarily. Right. Because what is going to happen, Dennis, let's say that you keep your house about 70 degrees, right? We're pretty normal in Wisconsin. And let's say your interior humidity is around 40%, which again is pretty normal in Wisconsin. That means when the interior surface of that window hits 43 degrees, you are going to condense moisture out of the air without any air leak whatsoever. That is simply because of the typical transference. So that's going to be like a U.27 type window. So what do you need for outside temperature to get down to that? Well, certainly when you get down to the teens, sometimes even the 20s, depending upon the quality of the window, you are going to end up having a problem. Now, there's this national organization called the National Fenestration Research Council. Most windows are going to have a little tag in them saying that they have been tested by this third-party tester and that they're certified. Now, something that they have added is they tell you how much sunlight's going to come in. They're going to tell you what the U factor is. But the other thing they're going to have is a 0 to 100 scale of how much condensation you get. So you may, if you know the brand of your windows, you may be able to look them up, and you'll find out how good or how bad they are as far as condensation. But it doesn't necessarily mean an air leak. If you are concerned with it, then the thing would be, and if you've got other concerns in the house, perhaps, as Larry and I said before, have an energy inspector take a look at it, or have a local building inspector who's got good thermal imaging equipment come and take a look at it, because air leaks are pretty easy to find.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there we go.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to the email for a minute. Tim in Waukesha emailed to ask about insulating the rim joist area of his basement. He's remodeling a 1950s ranch. He understands there are three basic options: foam board with spray foam around the edges, spray foam in the entire cavity, and fiberglass bat insulation. Which is best, and how much does he need to worry about moisture and condensation?
The one thing we don't know from Tim, Larry, is what he has on the exterior of his house.
Ah.
Now, let's assume it's wood siding. If it's wood siding, then the spray foam insulation is certainly going to be the best. We want to get at least R19, but since we've already spent the money to get the truck over there and the equipment heated up, let's go ahead and go to R27. That is going to give us a vapor barrier, a thermal barrier, and an air barrier all in one. But let's say he's got a 50s ranch and he's got brick on the exterior. If he's got brick on the exterior, I always worry about brick because we need some interior moisture drive to dry out that brick. And if moisture gets through that brick and wets the sheathing, we need it to dry to the interior. So if we have a brick or a stone house, some sort of cladding that's very unforgiving, then it's the plain old fiberglass.
Oh.
And what I do is I take, you know, have a, take a can of great stuff or the other, the spray urethane, do a little bit of picture framing so that you've got all the edges, so you have it air sealed, and then just put in your R19 to R26 batting. So the exterior cladding makes a difference. It's sort of like we were talking about when we opened the program on the old houses that might have a brick exterior without a vapor barrier.
There we go. Now let's go back to the phones and to Bonnie in Brookfield. Bonnie, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. My nephew redid my bathroom, and my grout is basically washing away as I take a shower.
Oh, dear.
I basically just want to know what are some of the things that could have gone wrong with the grout, or what are some of the reasons why this may be occurring, and what should we do about it? And I will take my answer off the phone.
All right.
Okay, thanks, Bonnie. Larry, if you don't mix grout correctly, that is if you buy the grout powder, which is what most professionals use, and you have some mixing errors, it can be a little bit more permeable than you really want. Most people, if they're doing a do-it-yourself, or Bonnie's nephew did, he probably went to the hardware store and bought some pre-mixed grout. Yeah. Well, we know how old that was. Did the can sit open for a while? Did it partially dry? There's all kinds of things that can go wrong, unfortunately. Even the if the area around it is too dry, you can suck the moisture out of the grout and you don't get a really good set and you get a lot of micro cracking. So one of two things we can do, one is have a professional tile person come in and analyze it, probably do a little scraping and do a basically tuck pointing the grout. Number two, go to a tile store and get one of these good quality silicone sealers. Basically, it's like you're putting floor wax on your tile. But if we can use this clear silicone so that the grout doesn't get wet, maybe that'll stop Bonnie's problem.
There we go. Thanks, Bonnie. Appreciate the call. And on to Vicki in Madison. Vicki, hi to you. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I listened earlier, and I think this is just going to confirm what I've thought for years. Quite a few years ago, we had extra insulation put in the attic. They came out and they did an audit similar to what you're talking about now, but I don't think it was as extensive as what you do now. But I noticed in the last few years that I'm getting sagging between the joists and my ceiling joists. I don't notice any mold or anything, and we haven't noticed any mold inside the roof, but I think that the moisture is getting in the insulation, and that's causing extra weight and causing all of this sagging. Can that happen? Am I right about that?
Vicki, how old is your house?
It was built in 1976, and then we added that extra insulation probably in the mid-90s.
Okay. Do you know whether you have a Visqueen vapor barrier in your attic?
Between the ceiling and the insulation, I do not know.
Okay.
I know that there's... Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, the thing to do would be to open up your attic hatch or access your attic, and then just push some insulation away. Be sure to wear a dust mask or a respirator when you do that, because if it's fiberglass or cellulose, it can be unpleasant to breathe. But see if you have a vapor barrier there. If you do, then you're probably not getting that much moisture up in the attic. If you are getting moisture in the attic, it almost certainly is going to show up on the roof sheathing. So if your roof sheathing is nice and clean, or maybe there's just a couple of rings around the nail penetrations, it's probably okay. It could be just the weight of the insulation. Now, go to where it's sagging and push up on it gently. Stand on a safe ladder, push up on it gently, and you will probably find where the nails and screws are. If they're nails and they weren't double nailed, That can be a problem and can cause sagging, or if the screws are too far apart. So it could be that all you need is to have a drywall finisher come in, add some more screws, set the ones that are loose, do a little bit of mudding and taping. So it may actually be nothing but a drywall problem.
Yeah. But it's not sagging where on the cross pieces where it's screwed in. It's sagging between those.
Well, I wonder how thick that drywall is. It's possible that was a 3/8 drywall. It's possible you have moisture, but you know, drywall is pretty unforgiving unless it's really being put up correctly. And remember, you've probably got with a 76 house, you've probably got trusses. You got 24 inches in between. So
yeah,
the weight of the insulation stuff could be causing some sagging there. So
okay.
One thing that you could certainly do is check Madison for a home inspector who is knowledgeable about these things. There's two sites you can go to. One is WAHI, Wisconsin Association of Home Inspectors, have a website. You get names of people and their specialties. The other is ASHI, American
Society
of Home Inspectors. Thank you, Larry. They also have a website where you can look for home inspectors, and they often note their specialties. So have somebody come in and inspect that area and figure it out for you, and then suggest how it can best be repaired.
Yeah.
I just don't want to come home someday and find half of my attic in my living room.
Yes.
Well, check in your attic, too, to see if you've got that vapor barrier in there.
And check the underside of your sheathing, because if the underside of your sheathing, on a day like today or tonight, when it's 10 or 0, if you have completely clean, dry attic sheathing, it's unlikely that it is vapor problems. Now, it's possible that you had a roof leak someplace and that roof leak propagated down. But if there was a vapor barrier, the vapor barrier controls the moisture and it usually leaks out one very discrete place.
Yeah.
So several things to consider. So I think a home inspector...
There was a roof leak by the chimney at one point, but my husband fixed that.
Yeah. So a little professional help from a home inspector, I think, is probably the way to go.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's move right on to John in Algoma. John, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a house that's two-story Cream City brick and about 100 years old. And we've spent the last 20 years renovating it, I guess. Practically everything in the house has been replaced. In the process of doing that, we wanted to do something about the walls. Now, if you look at the construction of the walls, it's brick, and then there's about a 2-inch space, and then 2x6 full-dimension studs. And this is a balloon-framed home, so it goes all the way to the second floor and the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And we had an insulator come in because the house was very leaky. We had put a complete set of Pella windows on the house, and still it wasn't particularly well insulated. So we had an insulator come in, bore holes through the lath and plaster, which is about a half inch thick, just the concrete plaster that they used, and blow insulation, cellulose insulation into the wall cavities. The outside of the 2x6s are covered with planks, so the insulation was held within the 2x6 cavity as opposed, and the 2 inches between the 2x6s and the brick wall still exists and is empty. We then painted the interior walls and the ceiling on the second floor with vapor barrier paint.
Right.
And I guess my question is, have I created a nightmare, even though I've gone through all those steps, including the vapor barrier paint, or should I feel comfortable about what we've done?
I think you can be relatively comfortable because the vapor barrier paint, I believe, has been approved, or at least at one time it was approved by the Department of Interior Division of Historic Restoration for historic homes. Now, I know your home maybe not on the register, but still, it's that age is historic. So what you've done, I think, has pretty much followed the guideline. The only other thing I would take a look at is I don't want to get air leakage, And so where you have switches and outlets in the outside walls, I would go to the hardware store and get those little foam things you can put on behind the faceplates, help seal that up. And I'm hoping that we don't have too much leaking still going into the walls that would be carrying, would be bypassing this vapor barrier paint. So that would be the thing to check for. Reduce the number of air leaks that you have, but it sounds like everything you've done conforms to what would be required of you if your home was on the registry and you'd be asking for tax credits.
Okay. Just one other. When we did when we first moved in, there was about 1 inch of insulation in the ceiling in the second floor. We've added enough so that we're up to 24 inches of insulation, and we have a solar blanket on top of that. However, there was no VisQueen between that, the upper side of the ceiling structure and the insulation. But again, we did the vapor barrier paint
right
for the ceiling. So am I probably okay there as well?
No, that's good. And the attics, as we said earlier, the attics are very easy to check this time of year. If you've got vapor transfer into the attic, you're going to find it. You're going to see the frost up there if you go up there with a flashlight this evening and take a look. So I would take a look. If you find you've got a nice dry attic, that should give you some good peace of mind that you followed the guidelines, you've been pretty thorough, and your house is operating correctly.
Yeah, there you go.
Super. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the information.
Yeah, thanks John. Appreciate the call. And Doug in Boston, thank you for calling. Hi.
How are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Say, we purchased a home that was built in about 2000. It has a split entry. And what they had done is replaced all the windows in the house with vinyl, but did not insulate around any of the windows. So I went in and I foamed everything and resealed everything up. But the basement is still approximately 15 degrees cooler than the upstairs. Is there any way that I can keep the heat down there better, or what else would I have to look for at this point?
Well, Doug, we're going to have to try to analyze the problem. Again, I think we're going to suggest that you hire an energy inspector.
Okay.
You know, the basement, I don't know how well or poorly your ring joists are insulated. In the year 2000, they maybe just have R19 insulation in, but maybe they leak a lot. If you have a lot of airflow coming out of your main floor ceilings up into the attic, that is depressurizing the upstairs, so then your basement is going to have lower air pressure than the outside. So you're going to have a lot of cold air coming into that basement. So I think what we need to do is we need to do some thermal imaging, have your energy inspector pressure test, and see what's going on. If your house is relatively tight, it could simply be that it's simply convection, you know, air stratifies, in which case you're probably going to just have to put a couple of heat runs that empty into the basement. But we don't want to do that until we find out first what the thermal transfer characteristics are in your house and whether we've got a big problem with air leakage. Because as we said earlier, we found the average house, 40% of the heat loss is air leakage. And again, think of a chimney. We know that air rises, right? We've all seen hot air balloons. Well, if that air is coming out of the top of your house, it's going to be sucking in air at the bottom because it's got to replace the air that's leaving. And so that chimney effect or stack effect can really cause issues. If you want, you can always Google stack effect, and I'm sure you'll find a dozen articles about how air moves in houses. And it sounds like I would suspect that you've got an air movement issue.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And John in New Berlin, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, how are you guys today?
Great, appreciate the call.
Okay, I have a mold problem in the attic.
Okay.
I've had the home inspector in. I've had the mold specialist confirm that it's not toxic, but it's something that needs to be remediated. So I'm getting conflicting advice into as to what needs to be done. I'm going to have the mold treated and the attic, you know, cleaned and treated. But my concern is once that's done, and I'm also going to get a new roof, is in terms of the insulation. On one breath, I've been told that I should get the attic insulation removed and have it air sealed and then put new insulation in. And the other breath, I said, well, no, if you do soffit and ridge vents, you don't have to worry about that because you'll have adequate ventilation in the attic. So anyway, where do I go from here? There is no vapor barrier on the ceiling.
Okay.
All right. So we've no vapor barrier, so we are going to be getting transference up there one way or the other. And we're going to get condensation on some solid surfaces. So your next mold problem may not be on the roof sheathing, it may be on the trusses or the ceiling joists. So I think that both bits of advice you got are correct. You do want to have correct venting for that attic. So we need to have the soffit vents, and we need to have, nowadays almost everything is ridge venting. And so I very strongly recommend that you have your roofer install those.
Yeah.
I would have all of that insulation vacuumed out. Unless it's a huge house, it's not that expensive. They bring in a giant truck and they suck it all out. And, John, how old is your house?
Vicky's. Late 70s.
Late 70s. Okay, good. So it's what? It's like an InsulSafe mineral wool, chopped fiberglass, something like that?
Yes, it's a fiberglass.
It's a fiberglass, yeah. So pretty easy to suck out.
Yes.
So I think I would get that out. I would then have your insulation contractor come in and put down perhaps 2 inches of spray on top of your drywall. That is going to get you roughly R12, R13 in thermal resistance, going to give you an air barrier, and is going to give you a vapor barrier.
Okay.
Then go ahead and put El Cheapo high-density cellulose over the top.
Okay.
And inexpensive insulation, go ahead. You know, why not insulate that thing to R60?
Okay.
You're going to have a house then, a 1970s house, that's going to exceed the current standards, and you should see a nice decrease in your heating and your cooling bills.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, your attic will be completely decoupled from the house. So if something evil ever goes on up there, you know, more mold or bats or a raccoon or something, your attic is breathing independently totally of the house. You've decoupled it. And so nothing up there that would be ever toxic in the future is going to bother you down below.
Okay. And the only question I have is there anything special at this point then? Is there anything special that I would have to have the insulation contractor deal with in terms of the shallow slope of the roof?
Yes. And talk to your insulation contractor, and what he's probably going to do is he's going to say, John, where we've got this shallow slope of the roof, we want to get as much thermal resistance, as much R value as possible in those areas. So I want to spray foam those up to the point where I can then begin using the cellulose. All right?
Yeah.
So we'll build that up with something, you know, cellulose is 3.14, 3.2 per inch, where urethane, you're anywhere from 6.2 to 7. So you've got twice the efficiency. So, you know, 6 inches of cellulose is okay, not great. 6 inches of urethane, you're off to a really good start.
Okay. And one final question, if I may. What type of specialist or home person do I need who's going to be able to figure out what it is that's causing a funky smell in the corners of the windows, bottom corners of the windows?
A funky smell in the bottom corners?
Yes.
And this is on the main floors of your house?
This is on the main floors of the house, and it will happen after winter, typically on the first few really warm days of spring.
Okay. Well, we've got a 1970s house. We may have a lot of air leaks around those windows. And it is possible that we're getting, you know, aspergillus and penicillin and some other molds because we're getting condensation out into those areas. That's the only thing I can think of. Now, there are people who do who can do air tests. Smells are always really, really difficult. I mean, there are people that do it, John, but you don't even want to think about it because it's $2,000 to ring the doorbell. So,
okay. Because I did have the windows replaced with inserts, with triple pane windserts.
Yes.
About a dozen years ago, and we're really thrilled with that. Except that they were they wrapped the old, you know, the wooden sills, and they were supposed to replace any rotted wood.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I did have somebody out here who we pulled the worst window, or pulled the worst wrapped window, and found that the sill underneath there was really rotted on the corner.
Right.
Yeah.
Which could have been leakage, but it also could be a sign that you've got condensation. So you may have those issues. Now, if you do, you can speak to somebody who does air test, mold air testing. How close is New Berlin to Madison?
We're closer to Milwaukee.
Closer to Milwaukee. Okay, so you're going to find several people over there who for probably between $400 and $500 will be able to come in, draw air, basically have a little machine, suck air through a filter around those windows. And I guess you probably want to do this in April or May, whenever you think it's bad.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll be able to take a look at what they get out of there, culture it, and tell you what you've got in there for spores, if there are a whole bunch of spores.
Yeah, there you go. And if it's bad, then...
If it's bad, then what we want to do is we want to take a look at the exterior, probably pull the casing off, try to air seal it, foam it from the outside so that we can stop that air moving...
Yeah.
From the inside to the outside, carrying moisture with it and condensing. And that's going to do two things and get rid of the funky smell. And secondly, the house is going to be easier to heat and cool.
There we go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call, John. John Freiberger, our guest today of Freiberger and Associates of Fitchburg. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at home improvement today, energy retrofits and air sealing with our guest, John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates. Always great to have him come by, and thank you for listening in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, and we'll turn right back to the phones and to Tom in La Crosse. Tom, thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. My son is considering buying and moving an existing house. Can you tell me the positives and negatives of doing something like that? And if he decides that it's very economical, what things should we be looking at or checking out to make, in order to help us decide?
Tom, how old is this house that your son is contemplating?
Built in 2006, I believe.
Okay, 2006. And this is a stick-built home. It is not a manufactured home that came in pieces or modular.
I think it is a modular home.
Okay, modular, or did it come in two parts or like 15 parts?
I don't know that for sure.
Okay, good to find out. There should be, if it is a manufactured home, near the electrical panel, there should be a tag. It's usually in red, saying who the manufacturer was, the model, and a bunch of information. They are very easy to move. They are designed for like 100-mile-an-hour winds, because they're going down the road at 70 into a 30-mile-an-hour wind, and basically they can be picked up pretty easily and moved. The quality of the house makes a lot of difference. If the house does not have good bracing, good shear walls, houses can rack on you. I have moved just about everything in my days, from a 7,000-square-foot Victorian three-story farmhouse to a 72-ton masonry building. So anything can be moved. What you're probably going to want to do is talk to a moving company and get an idea of what it's going to cost, and then talk to your mechanical contractors, because you're looking at new furnace, new ductwork, a lot of new plumbing, et cetera, and see whether it is going to make sense. But it certainly can be done. If it is a manufactured house, it's really quite easy.
Sometimes where the house is existing and where you move it to makes a big difference. I had... the Lake Home neighbor moved a large home from downtown Madison to the lake, and had to go through a number of areas where lines had to be adjusted, and there were all kinds of expenses associated with that move that need to be considered. Certainly, whatever the municipality is going to have to have a little input to it.
Right. And the home mover contractor, they're going to be used to this. So they will be able to put all those things in the pricing for you.
Yep.
Okay. How tough is it on the structure itself in moving? I think this would be like 15 miles.
Again, if it is a manufactured home, it's not tough at all. It may have been moved from Elkhart, Indiana. Who knows?
Okay.
Or it may have come out of Wausau. Putting those things on the highway, even at speed, is not a problem.
But what if it is a stick-built house?
It is a stick-built house. Well,
or if it is.
Then you are probably going to have to have an engineer do an inspection and tell you how easy it is. If you're moving this a lot of miles,
15 miles here.
15 miles, that starts to get really expensive.
Okay.
So, but start with it. Start with the mover. Have him look at it. It shouldn't cost you anything to get a price from somebody competent. And they may blow the idea out of the water for you, or they may say, well, this isn't too bad. I think we can get this little thing up the road.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. Good luck.
All right. Take care.
Thanks very much for calling. I remember that move of that house because it had to be at about 1 mile an hour, it looked like. And it took quite a while to move it those few miles from a couple of miles from the downtown Madison to Lake Monona.
It certainly can take a long time.
Let's go to Greg in New Berlin. Greg, hello.
Hi, Larry. Hi, John. This is what I have. Mid-50s Cape Cod second story rafters. I'm taking off the pinhole acoustical tile, and I have batting up there. It's 6 inches, but there's no vapor barrier. I saw on Amazon this rolls of 4 foot wide by 25 foot long, like Mylar. It's reflective on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a good idea to put up there?
Oh, well, the studies I've seen on this stuff is that it does absolutely nothing. I mean, that's what I've seen so far. I know the companies say it works, it reflects heat, et cetera, et cetera. I believe the studies that I've seen is that unless there's an airspace into which it can reflect heat, then it doesn't work. So
gotcha.
Now, let's say you're putting one of these attic blankets in on top of your insulation in the attic. Well, the summer heat may be reflected back up into the open attic. But using as part of an insulation system, I don't know of any scientific studies that says there's any value to it whatsoever. I would take a look if you.
What should I put on the rafters to hold up the batting then? So I have 2x4 rafters.
Right.
And then I have the solid insulation batting.
Yeah,
I would say
no batting. What you want to do first is you want to create a 1-inch airspace underneath the sheathing. That can be done with a lot of different materials. You can do it yourself with strips of plywood. You can go to CoreAvent, CoreAvent.com, and take a look at their spacers. But we want to have airflow from your soffits up to the ridge vent wherever possible so your shingles don't overheat. Then what we want to do is spray urethane, the 2.5 inches that we have left. That is going to get you up to about R15 to R17. Now, we want to get this up. R49 is the current code, which is the minimum standard. So we want to get at least another R30 out of that. That suggests probably 5 inches of foam put on the interior over the top of the rafters. And that also gets rid of the thermal bridging. At that point, you will have an airtight and warm second floor.
Yeah, that's the problem I'm having now. Before, it was just this thin cellulose, acoustical tile, and then the backing on that was this half-inch like cardboard.
Right,
yeah.
You
could tell back in the 60s. Not wood, nothing, not even plasterboard.
Right.
Put plasterboard up or wood, knotty pine beadboard. What goes in between that and the rafter itself before I even get to the insulation?
Well, you want more insulation. You want the sheet foam insulation between the rafters and the knotty pine or the drywall or the paneling or whatever you're going to be putting up there on the walls and the ceiling.
Okay. All right. So sheet paneling, what, 1 inch, half inch?
On the insulation, I think you're going to probably be 4 inches at a minimum.
Okay.
I mean, we're trying to, I guess, Greg, when I take a look at a house, if you call me and say, John, design this for me, I'm going to say, well, the worst house you can build in Wisconsin right now, these rafters have to be insulated to R49. I don't want to offer you an insulation program that is worse than the worst house you can legally build in Wisconsin. Cape Cods are really difficult. You've got all these bays and these other things, so it really takes somebody knowledgeable. since you're in the Milwaukee, you know, Waukesha area, yep, let's do some checking for a really good insulation contractor, someone that owns a thermal camera, and get a real expert in there to look at, or call three experts. It doesn't cost much to get some knowledge and estimates from people. But proceed with caution and do it right.
Well, Michelle, thank you very, very much, guys.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. George in Polk County asked if you have could discuss the heat recovery ventilator and dehumidistat system operation during the winter season. He runs continuously. Is this normal? Temperature 70, humidity 40%.
If it's running continuously, then we may have some extra humidity load in the house. What I would suggest he do is maybe go to the Cold Climate Research Office and download their sources of interior humidity. So if you've got a 20-pound Labrador, it's going to tell you how many pints of moisture that lab puts in the air each day. So let's locate why you're getting all this moisture in the house so that you have to run the HRV continuously.
And what's the name of that again? The
Cold Climate Housing Office. It's a research center in, I believe, Fairbanks, Alaska.
And you can find that online for sure.
Absolutely. They have a lot of great studies that people can access.
John Freiberger, our guest today, he's going to be with us right up until 12:30 to answer your questions. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. And we'll be back right after this look at the news. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking home improvement today with John Freiberger, a Wisconsin registered home inspector. His firm, Freiberger and Associates, consults in the restoration and adaptive reuse of old homes and other structures. You have some home improvement questions. I hope you'll join us. Number to call 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And let's go right back to the phones and Judy and Racine up next. Judy, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Thank you. I just was wondering, is it better to have a Focus on Energy audit in the winter or the summer, or does it matter?
If they're really, really, really good, you can do it both times a year. I'm not really, really, really good. I'm a home inspector with a thermal camera, to be truthful, and I'm not as good as those guys. So I really like it when I can go out and it's 70 degrees inside and it's zero outside, because I can really see everything. So I would say if the person has the really expensive cameras that most of these guys have, and they're $12,000 cameras, they can do it in the summer as well as the winter. The nice thing about the winter is we can see condensation, and that often gives us a little bit more information. So if you're thinking of having it done, I would book it as soon as possible.
Okay, and then if there's an issue, they don't actually do the repairs or whatever, do they?
No, they recommend.
Right, that would be a conflict of interest.
Now,
but let's talk about conflict of interest for a second. There are energy auditors who are independent consultants. There are energy auditors that work for insulation companies. If you have a choice, I would hire the one who is an independent person, because he does not have a vested interest in selling you something.
Yeah.
Right.
But will recommend what needs to be done.
Right.
Okay.
And they'll even try to calculate some of the payback for you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that information.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. And on to Chris in Adams, Wisconsin. Hi, Chris.
Good afternoon. I just moved into a little house. It's one of those wham bam thank you ma'am 1940s houses that was built after the war. And we're not dealing with the house here. There are two garages on the property. I have a 35-foot by 30-foot garage that can fit six cargo vans in it, and it's really nice. But there's this little bitty garage that is behind the house. It gets sun on all four sides of the building. It's a south exposure mostly. And I want to knock all it's leaking and the siding is falling off. And I want to knock all the siding off of it and knock the roof off and raise the roof up so it's at more of an angle, put solar panels on it. I have three questions I'm getting to. And I want to, the garage is at ground level. The house is about 3 feet above that. I want to pour a load of pea gravel in the bottom of this garage, put metal sheathing up, insulate the walls first, put metal sheathing up so that it holds the gravel in. And then I want to put substrate on there. And I was wondering if that's, that part is a possibility, if that's a good idea. And then I want to put solar panels on. We're going to have a new roof. What kind of roofing should I look for to do that the easiest with the most durability? And the third thing is I'm going to put a rather large koi pond in this garage because it's actually two cars deep. And I'm going to need some advice about ventilating the moisture out of there.
Heavens.
Wow. It's hard to wrap my mind around all that.
Yes, Chris.
The best part of the story is that this garage was built around a 25-foot boat on a trailer with a great big huge motor on it, and the boat came with the house.
And this garage, Chris, is also 1940s?
Yes.
Okay. I'm really suspicious of garage foundations. There's a real problem when we start adding weight on old foundations. This may be a slab on grade,
okay,
which was okay when you had a car parked inside.
Okay.
But then you add heavier walls and roof structure to it, then all of a sudden it starts sinking on the outside and coming up on the inside.
Okay.
My first impression is, let's just bulldoze the whole thing and start over.
Okay.
That way we can insulate the foundation. We know we've got the correct frost protection. We know we're starting out with something that is structurally sound.
What if I do concrete block?
You certainly can do concrete block. It needs to be done right. You need to have the rebars in. It needs to be grouted. There's a few issues with concrete block underground.
What about the styrofoam stuff that they pour concrete in?
Good luck.
Oh.
Well, we've yet to find a contractor that knows how to do it right. But
okay,
you're looking at something pretty simple with short walls, so that might actually work for you. But when we're doing 8-foot walls, we are having a terrible time finding people that know how to do it right. But you've got a little different situation there, and you're not going to have a basement or a crawl space. And we do want to make sure that we've got that foundation insulation, so that might be something to look at. Let me get to the roof thing real quickly. If we're having solar panels and stuff that we're going to have to access, I don't like metal roofing, even though metal roofing is a great product, because it tends to be a little bit slippery. The penetrations are a little bit less forgiving. The best roof that I think is out there is the one that you can get a lifetime warranty on labor and materials. Maybe there's another one out there, but I know that GAF Corporation does offer a lifetime warranty as long as you use a GAF certified installer who is someone who, you know, someone who's gone to school.
Now that's rubber roofing, right?
No, that is a architectural grade laminated shingle.
Oh, okay.
And it isn't all that expensive. You probably on a little garage you might have a $200 insurance policy that covers it for the lifetime, but boy, $200 isn't much if that garage can be there for 50 years.
Okay.
All right.
Uh-huh. Oh, and the koi pond.
You're going to need... You know, I'm not licensed to do koi pond design, or I'd love to.
I just need to know, because there's going to be a lot of tropical plants in there, too, and I need to know if humidity... In the summertime...
The humidity is going to be a huge problem in the winter.
Okay.
And you're going to have an HRV or something like that, or you're going to get a lot of condensation, or you're going to have to build this out of materials that, if they get wet, nothing happens. And I think you actually need to talk to an architect if you're going to be putting a koi pond in
glass.
There. It's going to be mostly glass.
Yeah.
Your glass is probably going to be condensing all winter long.
Okay.
It's like having a swimming pool.
Yeah.
You're looking at a very expensive ERV or HRV and system in there. So I would approach that very, very carefully.
Okay. And then I can order my fish and be happy.
Yeah.
Right.
After you spend a couple of dollars or more. Good luck, Chris. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, let's go to Jill in Cedarburg next. Hi, Jill.
Hi, good afternoon. Hey, I have a boiler. It's about 20 years old, and we are having a terrible time with gurgling noises and banging of what sounds like pipes.
Yeah.
We've drained it. We've checked for leaks everywhere. We've gotten all the air out of the system, but every single time Within a couple of days, sometimes just a couple of hours, the gurgling, noising, the clanking is back. I'm just wondering, is it the age of the boiler and it's time to replace sediment getting in there? Maybe the pressure tank or a pressure valve needing to be replaced. Everything looks good. Like I said, no leaks. Just looking for some advice because it's driving me nuts, and I'm ready to switch to a gas furnace.
Yeah, so this is a hot water boiler that has circulation pumps, correct?
Correct.
Right. Okay. Yeah, the air in the system is usually what causes our problems, but you said that's already been tested, and they've probably pressure tested at 75 pounds or something like that to be sure. This is really beyond what we can really discuss on the radio because there are so many factors. I'm afraid you really need to talk to a good boiler person. He's probably going to be more than 50 years old. and have him really take a look at it. Remember, hot water boilers have changed so much in 20 years. You've probably got a 75% seasonally efficient boiler. You can get one now that's rated at 96 and will probably operate at 98. There's absolutely nothing wrong with hot water heat at all. Sounds like you've got a little bit of a problem, but find out the problem and then maybe take a look at putting in a condensing modern boiler, especially if you like the comfort that is provided by the hot water heat. But find a good specialist and interview them extensively.
Okay. Do you know the average cost of putting a new boiler like that in?
I'm going to pull $5,600 out of the air, but of course, it really depends upon the size of the house, the type of boiler, et cetera. And they are so remarkably small now. Most of them hang on the wall now. They don't even put them on the floor. They're so small.
Okay. Well, thanks for your help. I really appreciate it.
Yeah,
thanks for calling, Joe.
And good luck. Appreciate it. And Patrick in Wisconsin Dells, on to you now. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, Larry. How are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I'm building a new house in the Dells, and we're doing a low-sloped roof, and we're using I-joists, 14-inch I-joists, and we're taking that airspace above and leaving that and putting in rigid foam up there, and then later on going to have somebody come in and spray 5 inches of rigid foam on top of that. So we have the airspace. And then that way we're putting a steel roof on top of the roof. Mm-hmm. The walls, where they meet over the walls, we're also putting in blocks of foam and then air sealing around that. But then having them spray 3 inches of rigid, which should get us to R31 with over the edges, and then they'll be at R45 on the ceiling, and then we'll add bats because we'll still have another 5.5 inches of space.
Okay. So we're going to be up at about R60 then when all is said is done. One thing to always check on when you're interfacing a sprayed foam and a sheet foam is spray foam is exothermic. In other words, it gets hot. We want to make sure we don't melt anything.
Right.
So you're going to have to do some checking. I would make sure that your insulation contractor, don't have the carpenters put in the sheet foam and then the insulation guys spray. Have the insulation contractor do everything, because then if there's something wrong, you can point to the culprit with just one finger.
Okay.
So that sounds like you're doing the right things. You've got your 1-inch air space. You've got your venting underneath your metal roof, which is great. You're shooting for R60, which is what I usually design to. You may want to take a look at spraying those edges instead of putting in the blocking, just because you're going to get a little bit more R factor per inch with the spray foam than you are with the sheet foam. And you may want to take a look at doing the entire thing in spray, except for the part that you're going to be doing in the 5 inches or so of cellulose. You might find that there really is no great cost benefit to doing the sheet foam.
Okay. And then as far as the inside walls, it's 2x6 construction. We have 1-inch foam on the outside. We're planning on just cutting, because we can actually do it pretty cheap with the labor we have, of 2-inch rigid foam, air sealing that ourselves with the Pro Gun, and then basically putting in bats for the rest of the 3.5.
Yeah, I would prefer to see more insulation on the outside. We've talked about this a little bit. Let me suggest you take a look at the Cold Climate Housing Research Center which is cchrc.org. Take a look at Research Snapshot 7-03 and some other associated ones that talk about the benefits of exterior insulation techniques, and you may find that you're going to get better performance. Remember, we were talking earlier about trying to get 60% of the insulation on the outside, and right. I think that's really where the state of the art is at this point as far as ASHRAE, Cold Climate Housing Office, and a lot of the organizations that are really researching very carefully.
We've had a hard time getting siding after you get past an inch.
What you want to take a look at is doing a rain screen system.
Right.
You'll actually see a rain screen system being put on in Research Snapshot 7-03. And you can certainly Google rain screen systems. You'll find a specification from the Forest Products Lab here. But what you're doing then is you've got your foam on, you've got your wood strips then over the foam, and then you're applying your siding. Certainly if you're using siding such as LP Smart Side, natural cedar siding, etc., there's no way you want to apply that siding directly against foam because it will cause rapid deterioration.
Right.
By trapping moisture.
But you can put Tyvek on top of the foam.
I put the Tyvek under the foam. I put the Tyvek over the house sheathing and then add the foam over it, and then I tape the foam so I've got a double weather-resistant barrier and I've got a double exterior air barrier. And it's going to cost you, $50 more for the foam tape.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for calling. And on to Wayne in Marshfield, Wisconsin. Hi, Wayne.
Good afternoon. I'll make this short. I'm an advocate for ground source heating and cooling, and I've volunteered a number of winters at a mission training center in Dallas, Texas. And 250 transfer wells were put under a soccer field, and various buildings were added. And when they say you can save up to 70%, that is true, because a cafeteria building was costing $4.50 per square foot per year to heat and cool, and on the ground source, it went down to $1.50 per square foot. So I think it's worth the investment rather than conventional air pumps, heat pumps, and so on. I think it's the way to go.
I agree with you, Wayne. I have designed several of these. When we get in Wisconsin, we do have some special concerns because of if we're using, say, a hot water heat system, sometimes we have trouble getting our temperatures up high enough just with ground source, and we have to have a backup boiler to pump that temperature up. So I think it's a wonderful idea. It's good. Certainly, it's wonderful for cooling in the summer.
Yeah, it's great.
Absolutely great. But you need to work with somebody. You don't want to work with someone who's never done this before.
No.
You have to look at it really, really carefully, and you've got to design your envelope so that the BTUs you're getting out of the ground, plus your backup, either your gas furnace, your electric resistance heat, or your backup boiler, are going to be perfectly adequate. Because we've seen lots and lots and lots of systems where people have put them in and they fought with them for the next 5 years. So in Wisconsin, we've got to be careful because of how cold our temperatures get, how big some of our houses are, and the number of BTUs per hour that we may need. I have a house right now that has 120,000 BTUs of ground source. We have trouble keeping it warm. They have to run the boilers. The people are very disappointed that that they have to run the boilers because they really thought, you know, they're real advocates, as are you. They really hope they could do the entire thing with ground source, but we found that they couldn't.
Yeah, there we go.
Thank you for calling, Wayne.
Thank you very much, Wayne. I want to give Ann in Brilliant a chance to join us. Ann, hello to you.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to know, what do you think of Rosco windows? Because I can clean them so nice.
Rosco windows.
Rosco. Ann, I don't know much about them. What I would do, we mentioned earlier the National Fenestration Research Council. I would take a look at what the ratings are. And remember, we've got ratings for the U factor, which is the thermal transmission. We have a rating for how much sun they reflect and how much heat gain you get in the summer. We've got a rating for the condensation. So take a look at Roscoe, and then take a look at some of the industry, you know, the industry leaders. You know, Marvin, I always put at the top of the leaderboard, and then with the better lines of Pella and Anderson next, and compare them against at least three other windows before you make a decision.
Yeah, and what's the name of that site again?
It is the National Fenestration Research Council, and I believe the website is nfrc.org.
Okay, there we go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Fred in Duluth, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Fred.
Hi, everyone. How are you doing today?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Say, I have an old refurbished warehouse that has been turned into lofts. And when they put the windows in, they cut into the brick exterior and used a metal I-beam for the lintel over the windows. And I'm having some of the residents tell me that that metal I-beam in the coldest nights where it's sub-zero, frost will build up on that. And then exactly as the day progresses, that frost melts and it starts to run down the windows. I'm just wondering if there's anything that can be done to mitigate that.
Yes, there is. We're looking at spray foam insulation. I don't know, where is this located in the wall? It's right towards the exterior. And is this actually a mass wall? That is, it's a real masonry wall, not a masonry veneer?
Yeah, the building's 100 years old, so it's probably a 12-inch thick brick wall.
Okay.
With a lintel that sits under, that was cut in and then placed into the masonry.
And is the lintel towards the exterior of the wall or towards the interior or right in the middle?
It's pretty close to in the middle. It's probably a little bit leaning towards the exterior.
Great. Okay. Middle would be just about perfect. So what we're going to be looking at doing is adding a foam insulation on both the exterior and the interior, probably with a spray, and then being able to put some sort of nice looking cap over the top of that. You're probably going to have to talk to a local insulation contractor up there that does spray foam. What we need to do is we need, number one, we get it air sealed with the spray foam so that the moisture can't get to it because the air can't get to it. Number two, we're going to try to raise the temperature of it so it doesn't hit the dew point.
Perfect. Sounds great, gentlemen. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Lori emailed to say she had her 1941 home assessed a few years ago through Energy Star. They recommended blown insulation, which they did in the walls and attic. They also added a high-power ceiling vent in the bathroom to help pull fresh air into the house. Her house is a 2x4 construction with Doug fir sheathing and cedar siding and had a thin layer of tar paper insulation prior to the blown-in insulation. She asked about moisture. They said it would be fine with the fan in the bathroom. Did she get good advice?
Maybe. Well, as we've discussed before, we had the gentleman that called in later that applied the vapor barrier paint. And if Laurie's concerned with that, I think taking a look at vapor barrier paints and painting the interior, trying to stop all air leaks would be a good idea. She's got a fairly forgiving house, but we could be getting condensation in that wall because the backside of that sheathing is probably going to be lower than 43 degrees. It certainly is today because I don't think there's any insulation on the exterior. There's probably tar paper on the outside, but that's really not an insulator. It's just a weather-resistant barrier. So you want to keep the humidity down. Certainly bathroom fans help, but buy a humidistat. You want to keep it around 40 and consider painting the interior with the vapor barrier paint.
On that note, John, we're done. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Great, great fun. Great callers, Larry.
John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates of Fitchburg, our guest today, and he'll be back in a couple of months. We'll do it all over again. Thank you for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store.